Welcome to the Holistic Health Podcast, beautiful humans. If a professional, polished, well-edited podcast is what you're after, then move right on.
If, however, you love unfiltered banter, unedited bloopers, authentic heart sharing, and a very generous dash of holistic health education, then you're in the right place.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Holistic Health Podcast. A doozy for you today, a absolute doozy. And by that, I mean just a heavy topic to be chatting about, but a really important conversation to be having, which is about bipolar disorder and also the link with mold, because it is something that is far more common than perhaps you had realized. It's certainly far more common than I realized. Mm-hmm. And as with everything mold, Amy will absolutely not let you not understand what's happening. So where I might actually begin is just to talk a little bit more about what bipolar disorder is. And by definition, it is a severe and complex mental illness with a strong genetic component that affects 2% of the world population. Mm-hmm. And it is considered a mental health condition that can cause extreme mood swings that include emotional highs, so mania or hypomania, and lows, i.e. depression. And usually it first affects people when they're in their 20s. And, you know, manic episodes may include, you know, symptoms such as high energy, reduced need for sleep, and loss of touch with reality. And depressive episodes may include symptoms such as low energy, low motivation, and loss of interest in daily activities. And mood episodes last days to months at a time and may also be associated with suicidal thoughts. And from a conventional treatment perspective, it's usually lifelong and often involves a combination of medications and psychotherapy. Mm. And actually, like within bipolar, there are several different types, about seven different types. I'm not going to go into each and every one. What I will do is just share the two most common ones, which are creatively known as bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. So bipolar 1.
Groundbreaking.
Just wild, really. I mean, they come up with complex names for everything and now they've decided to just like simple sell it, but that's okay. So bipolar 1, so you might get a diagnosis of this if you've experienced at least one episode of mania, which has lasted longer than a week, and some depressive episodes too, although not everyone does. And then bipolar 2 is at least one depressive episode and symptoms of hypomania that have lasted at least 4 days. And then, yeah, as I said, there are other types of bipolar that you can have a look into if you'd like to, but just focusing on those first two for the context of this conversation, because they are most relevant to what we're going to speak to in a moment. And the exact cause of bipolar disorder isn't known, but a combination of, yeah, genetics, environment, and also altered brain structure and chemistry may play a role. And speaking of things that impact your brain and your brain chemistry, do you want to share a little bit more about mycotoxins? And which, for anyone who needs a little reminder, mycotoxins are the toxins produced by mold. And, you know, yeah, just the effect on the brain.
Yes, I'd love to, Nat. Thank you.
Hand over
the speaking pipe, will you? So, look, as Nat said, this is obviously a heavier subject, and the reason that we're talking about it today, even though we prefer to keep things a bit more light and fun, as a standard, is because having been injured by mold toxins myself and having had it affect my brain, not in this way, but in the way that it impacted me, I now see, after dealing with a lot of mold clients and also providing support in a Facebook group, just how much toxicity and inflammation can affect brain health and therefore drive not just cognitive function, but behavioral function and mood. So neurocognitive and neurobehavioral issues whilst Nat's pointed out, is a combination of, you know, genetics, environment, et cetera, a huge environmental factor that I don't think is looked at is the element of the microbiome of the buildings people are spending their time in. And I have to say, bipolar and schizophrenia are the two that I see most commonly that can be set off, or, you know, maybe it's the straw that breaks the camel's back in some patients. Now, if you're listening to this and you have bipolar disorder, not everyone with this issue, which regardless of which type you have, is necessarily going to be driven or caused by mold or even influenced by toxic mold. But some of you will be. And if no one is looking at the environmental influence on the health of your brain, the purpose of this episode is to say, hey, what about checking this out and addressing it if it appears to be an issue for you? Now, what's really encouraging about this is, unlike things like seizures, by the way, we did just recently do an episode on the connection between seizures, potentially epilepsy, and mycotoxins. That was episode 109. We do cover a lot of really interesting ground in there as well. So if this is a concern to you, I would actually encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. Also, some of our earliest episodes were on, you know, how do you identify if mold is making you sick in other ways? But when you actually Google toxic mold and bipolar disorder, there are a lot of articles that are highlighting the connection. There's actually one on psychologytoday.com, which interestingly was published in 2017, the same year I got sick with toxic mold. And it outlines how mold toxicity is actually a common cause of psychiatric symptoms. And if you scroll down further, you know, there are other psychology websites talking about the link between black mold and depression. You know, there's another clinic that says, is it mental illness or is it mold toxicity? Is it psychiatric illness or is it a moldy brain? There is articles in the psychiatry field talking about the link between mold and mental health. But unfortunately, because environmental medicine isn't taught in the curriculum of either allopathic or naturopathic medicine, it is typically something that is either a gap in the education or not understood well enough for clinicians, psychologists or psychiatrists, or even GPs. And in fact, most naturopaths, they're not able to identify and screen for it, let alone know what biomarkers to test for, let alone how to treat it and how to fix the environment. So knowing that mold can trigger psychiatric symptoms, and that's a whole spectrum, by the way, not just bipolar disorder. To the purpose of our chat today is really to connect the dots to bipolar specifically. And what I will say about that is the connection between the biomarkers that we see triggered in mold illness or in SIRS especially seem to be associated with bipolar disorder type 1. So let's dive in there. We see there is a significant association between the expression of C4A, which is an inflammatory cytokine, and psychotic mood episodes in bipolar disorder type 1. Now, C4A can be triggered by other things, but C4A is one of the hallmark features of mold illness in someone who is genetically susceptible. And is ultimately, it's one of the part of the, I guess, the laundry list of biomarkers we look at and would constitute how we would diagnose a case of SIRS or how a case of SIRS would be diagnosed.
When you say biomarkers, what that means is like blood tests like that people can get done, right?
Yes, exactly. So biomarkers can also sometimes be found in other tissue or other secretions. That feels like such a dirty word to say. Saliva, urine, stools. I mean, we can look for biomarkers anywhere, and they're really just markers of your, you know, physiology, your physiological status. Hang on. We're just going to. So luckily I'm editing this episode.
Sort out your secretions, Amy Skilton.
Oh my God, that was just too funny. Give me just one moment.
I think you should leave it in.
I am. I'm going to leave that in. I am. It's too funny not to.
Yeah. We've all gotten them. It's okay.
Yes, we do. Okay, so back to the secretions. But in this case, we're talking about blood tests. So C4A is tested for in the blood. Now, why is this an important one? It is a powerful inflammatory mediator, and it also crosses the blood-brain barrier. And so it can cause significant amounts of brain inflammation. This can trigger the kynurenine pathway, which affects quinolinic acid. And there's a whole cascade that happens with brain health that can actually cause all kinds of mental and emotional disorders to arise. It's even been associated with things like ADD and other mood challenges. But we know that C4A is one of those hallmark biomarkers that gets triggered in mold illness. We often will screen for that and C3A to determine whether, you know, mold-related SIRS is present, or Lyme or Lyme-like illness-related SIRS is present, or both. But C4A is quite specific for mold when you're using it through that lens and with the other diagnostic features. So that's a really big one that I think is worth investigating. Another one that is also commonly triggered and found to be elevated, like C4A, is a biomarker called TGF-beta-1, or that stands for transforming growth factor beta-1. Again, it's another inflammatory cytokine. And interestingly, TGF-beta-1 is being considered a potential predictive biomarker in the treatment of bipolar 1 disorder with acute manic episodes. So again, this is another interesting biomarker that we know is triggered in a water damaged building and those that are genetically susceptible, and also is connected with this condition. Now, in some ways, we can zoom out and say everything is, you know, inflammatory and or toxin driven, and how it presents for someone, and also maybe, you know, nutritional deficiencies or heavy metal excesses. But knowing that these are biomarkers that we see triggered by a water damage building or mycotoxins, and that they are connected with this disorder, I think it's definitely it gives you a place to start. You know, it gives you blood tests to order to actually see what might be going on. Now, another element that we know is common in SIRS patients, by the way, this is the first time you've heard me rant about mold. Welcome. I do it a lot.
Initiated.
Yeah. And I just realized I'm saying SIRS like you know what it is. So if this is the first time you're hearing it, the acronym is spelled CIRS and stands for Chronic Inflammatory Response Syndrome. Now, it is not a disease. It is a syndrome or a collection of symptoms. And actually, there can be a number of triggers. Lyme disease is a version of SIRS. So is mold illness. So is breast implant illness. But we're speaking now about the mold version. And what we know in SIRS patients, mold SIRS patients, is that in 95% of them, there is a brain peptide, a regulatory peptide called alpha melanocyte stimulating hormone, or MSH for short, that is low. It's low in 95% of mold patients. And there is a relationship there with both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And ultimately, there's a lot of different things MSH plays a role in. And it's also, a downstream indicator of another compound called POMC. And we won't get too technical, but ultimately, it's an indicator of the presence of brain inflammation. And without sufficient levels, it's difficult to get brain inflammation under control. Now, that would require the use of something called BDNF. We also know that low BDNF levels are found in those individuals with mood disorders like bipolar disorder. So as you can see, there's a lot of connections there to follow. And I think the reason there isn't more literature on it is because it's a syndrome and it's so complex. It's a complex what's the word I'm looking for? I can't think of the word that I really want to say, but there's an intersection. There it is. It's a complex intersection of genetics, environment, and usually a couple of other little factors in there that collide. And so it's very complex to unravel from a diagnostic perspective, but it's also very challenging to treat for a lot of reasons. And so, you know, toxicology doesn't like things to be complex. They like to look at things in isolation. So there's still a lot of work to be done here. But if we dip a toe in the toxicology field, we can also see that there are connections between mycotoxins themselves and neurotoxicity, and also therefore neurocognitive and neurobehavioral disorders. So we know trichothecenes, these are mycotoxins. They're probably one of the most poisonous ones. And the one, and this is produced by, in particular, a species called Stachybotrys. That's the one that's called black mold or toxic mold, or most commonly dubbed that, when actually there's, you know, there's actually a number of toxin producing fungi that are an issue. But this is the one that people tend to have in mind when they say toxic mold. And we know the way that basically all of the mold toxins are lipophilic. What does that mean? It can cross the blood-brain barrier and is attracted to fatty tissue. The brain is just a big ball of lard, like a supercomputer wrapped in butter, basically. And so, you know, those kinds of toxins are absorbed into fatty tissue preferentially. And we know that these toxins, both directly and also indirectly via inflammation, inhibit mitochondrial function. Now, mitochondria, a little reminder if you haven't heard that term in a while, or maybe this is new, is the parts of our cells that make energy and therefore allow our cells to actually function. And the way I would describe it is it's a little bit like the engine of your car. If your engine isn't working, your car doesn't go anywhere. So if you're not making energy in the cells can't do their job properly, which means your brain cells, if they're not getting enough energy, don't function well. Now, when we think about the way it impacts energy production in the body, our brain actually uses 25% of all of our available energy. So
some of our brains do.
Some of our brains.
I'm sure there's some people that are underfunctioning.
Well, you know what though? I wonder if anyone's brains who are underfunctioning simply have a mitochondrial issue. And of course, mold is just one reason why they might. But as soon as you have mitochondrial damage, one of the places it shows up first is brain fog, bad memory, slow cognitive, like the cogs aren't turning fast enough. And in the case of, you know, mycotoxin-induced neurotoxicity, we know that trichothecenes are associated with bipolar disorder, depression, and schizophrenia. And certainly that there are other connections there with neurocognitive and neurobehavioral issues. So that would be the main one, I would say. But we also know ochratoxin A, which is produced by Fusarium species, also found in a water-damaged building. Some really terrifying research on that in the agricultural and veterinary, you know, fields, where ochratoxin A, we know it damages human astrocytes or a type of brain cell, but it actually in horses causes their brain to liquefy. It's so toxic. Now, in the case of this horse study I'm thinking of, the volume that would have been onboarded was high because it came in through the food, but we absorb lipophilic mycotoxins through the skin and through our respiratory system and through our eyes directly into our brain, as well as, of course, what we would swallow, what's airborne. And so certainly in terms of ochratoxin A, we also can't sort of take that off the table for consideration. And lastly, I'll just say there was a really interesting, there's a couple of interesting case studies that I wanted to share. One of them actually is more relevant to the section you're going to talk about, Nat. So I might save that for after you've spoken about the other drivers of bipolar. But in terms of overall increased toxins, and in particular when it comes to mycotoxins, there was a really interesting article by a doctor. Gosh, I'm going to absolutely butcher his name. If he ever listens to this, please don't come for me, Rick.
Yeah, he's a low, but
yeah. He's an MD in Florida, and his name is Dr. Rick Sponigule.
Dr. Dr. IS.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. We'll just call him Dr. Rick.
Ricky S.
Yeah, Ricky S. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Thank you. I should have run this past you before we hit record. He actually presented at a conference again in 2017, the year I got sick, correlating toxin levels with changes in neurotransmitter levels and neurotransmitter testing. And he wasn't just testing mycotoxins, but he was also testing that. And he was seeing a lot of children, but also adults with ochratoxin poisoning. So the toxin that I've just spoken about, that was also one of the toxins that I onboarded from the water damage department that I was living in. And what he was able to figure out was ochratoxin actually downregulates the function of the conversion of dopamine to noradrenaline, or in his article, he calls it norepinephrine because he's American. But we see, yeah, a significant downregulation in the conversion of dopamine to noradrenaline because of the impact of ochratoxin A on an enzyme called dopamine beta hydroxylase. So this is really interesting when you think about what that would create. It would cause an excess of dopamine, which I'm sure would affect the mood, possibly related to mania, but also you lose noradrenaline. And of course, we know that that impacts attention, and that might be its connection with ADD there as well. But also dopamine activates a neuron receptor on cardiac neurons and the primary cardiac pacemaker, the SA node. And what I do see with a lot of mold patients is palpitations, atrial fibrillation. And in this case, he found significant elevated dopamine levels can lead to severe sinus tachycardia. And he was really talking about that in relation to POTS, which is a common secondary issue with mold as well. So we're really just starting to uncover all of these connections. But the reason we're talking about it before there's a huge body of evidence is because if you or someone you love is dealing with a neurocognitive issue or a neurobehavioral issue, and you don't yet know that your home or your office, if there's a mold issue or water damage, could be a major player in what you're experiencing, then I want you to have the opportunity to actually follow this. Now, all of that being said, there are, of course, lots of other drivers to bipolar disorder. Nat touched on genetic and environmental things when she defined that for us at the beginning of the episode. So, Nat, I know you've got a couple of sort of really common things you want to drop into this conversation too, because as practitioners, we're always looking for the root cause and we want to be holistic with our screening. Yeah, there are definitely some heavy metal mineral factors here that I think people would be really interested in hearing about too.
Yes. So I would say, yeah, just to add to that, exactly what you said around the heavy metals. So some examples of that would be that urinary tin. So when I say urinary, it's like when you're doing a test, they can test your heavy metal load in your system in lots of different ways, but urine testing is one way that it's done. And urinary tin and antinomy were separately associated with elevated depression risk, and also lead and cadmium disrupt mitochondrial function through lots of different processes, leading to energy metabolism and malfunctions in mitochondrial biochemical cascade. So essentially, like, it just disrupts your ability to appropriately create and access energy in all parts of your body, including what we're speaking to around having balanced biochemistry or balanced brain chemicals in your mind that would lead to you feeling like you can concentrate properly or that your mood is balanced as well. And there are lots of other studies as well that look into bipolar, major depressive disorder and schizophrenia that link heavy metal toxicity to those, at least associations. So it's certainly something that's worth considering if you are someone who is likely to have been exposed to heavy metals, or you've ruled out all other things and this feels like something that hasn't been looked into yet. There are certainly ways of looking into heavy metal load in the body and seeing if perhaps that is a contributing factor to your story. And then what else did you want to add there, Ames, in terms of just other contributing factors?
A few nutrient deficiencies to consider. Low zinc is associated with depression and comorbid depression and other psychiatric disorders. And there are actually studies that show low levels of zinc in the depressive phase of bipolar disorder, particularly type 1, significantly being reduced in the manic phase, but also sometimes in the depressive phase. And interestingly, there's a connection there with magnesium too, where in patients with untreated bipolar disorder, there's a significant decrease in intracellular magnesium alongside plasma zinc. And magnesium is actually considered to be beneficial for reducing mania symptoms of type 1 bipolar disorder. So there's definitely some interesting things to consider in there. Other toxins need to be considered as well, not just mold toxins. There is a relationship between organic solvent exposure and bipolar disorder. And actually, the case study I wanted to quickly mention was on a woman, 33-year-old, 1996, generally well, non-smoker, doesn't use recreational drugs, no prior history of physical or mental illness, suffered a full-blown manic episode, including hallucinations, insomnia, cognitive impairment, delusional thoughts, and she was hospitalized as a result of this. However, she'd been employed by a printing company for 15 years and had been exposed to numerous chemical toxins through direct skin contact and inhalation. And so she was asked to have her assessed for chemical poisoning. She was admitted to a psych unit and was put on antipsychotic medications, and she remained really unwell for a couple of years and also experienced harsh side effects from, the drugs, including weight gain, which was really sad. And then after those couple of years, she was actually seen by a physician who was trained in environmental health science. And they found that she had accumulated high levels of lead. And she, there was a couple of other things they picked up, but that was kind of the main one. And then when she was treated for that, she actually improved. Her psychiatric symptoms gradually subsided. She was eventually able to come off all medication. And then remained well for 10 years after she was followed. Now, this was just a really interesting case in the sense that a lot of people, when they're diagnosed with something, feel like that's a label that they are then shackled to for the rest of their life, and that they're going to require medication for the rest of their life. And when you've treated the underlying cause, obviously that's not going to be the case. So it's obviously a lot to take in, but Nat, I think, would you mind running our friends just through a couple of indicators of what a water damage building might look like? Because unless it's obvious, like there's been a water leak or a flood, and you know that your symptoms started after one of those things, someone might not know that there's actually an issue with water damage in their home or office. But there are some other sneaky signs, aren't there?
There are, my friends. Keep a lookout. So a few things or a few key or common things would be like a musty odour would be one. So if you don't have a great sense of smell, take someone with you that does when you're looking at apartments or buildings. Also peeling paint or bubbling paint as well, or discoloration of the ceilings or the walls. Or same deal with like looking at the floors and the carpet. So if you're seeing like lifted floorboards or lifted parts of carpet, I mean, it can be lifted potentially for other reasons, but that's just one thing to consider. Or also like where you can see like staining on carpets where clearly there's been, you know, water or liquid or something moist dropped there. Oh my gosh, that's such a bad thing to say, something moist dropped there. Did you hear that? Especially in the same podcast that we're speaking about secretions. Anyway, we'll just move right along and pretend that I didn't say that. And the other thing that I would say is if you notice that like any kind of clothing, footwear, bags, shoes, etc., you pull them out of the cupboard and they actually have mold in there. It's not the bag or the shoes that is the problem. It's the environment that it's been sitting in. So those would probably be some of the most common ones.
Yes. And look, if you would like a mini masterclass on what to look for, I've got a free webinar that you can register for. You just need to DM me the word webinar and I'll send you the link, or rather my little automated Instagram bot will do it
well, though.
Yeah, maybe, yeah, we'll do it for
them. They can get it whenever they like. So
yeah, yeah,
advantage of it.
Yeah, any time of day or night, instant response. And also, if you would like to cross-check any of your other symptoms with symptoms that are commonly induced by living or working in a water-damaged building, you can also DM me the word ebook and I'll flick you the free ebook that I wrote that covers off, I think it's about 15 sort of major players, and the 15th one is sort of all of the SIRS symptoms. So you might recognize some things in there as well, which will help you connect some dots. And if that all seems a bit overwhelming, or you've looked at it and you're like, I'm still not sure, or you just want to just cut straight to the chase and talk to me directly, if you DM me on Instagram the word mold, I will send you, or my my autobot receptionist will send you the link to book in for a chat with me so we can unpack it together. Ultimately, yeah, I hope that if you've listened to this episode and you made it this far, thank you. We don't make a habit of saying moist and secretions in our episodes.
At least not when we're recording.
Truly, we don't. But if this is something that you think, oh, I wonder if this is what's going on for me, obviously we are here for you. Nat is also very well versed in this area. So please reach out. And if you have someone in your life that you love who might be dealing with this themselves, we'd love it if you would share the episode with them. In case it's something of use to them as well.
Amazing. We'll speak to you guys next week.
All right. Bye for now. You've been listening to the Holistic Health Podcast with Amy and Nat.
If you loved this episode, then make sure you share it on Instagram and give us a tag.
If you'd like to help us spread the holistic health message far and wide, then we would also so appreciate it if you left a rating and review. This helps us more than you know.
And don't forget to come and say hi over on Instagram. See you next week.